Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is presented by Forever Cheese. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and my guest today, I'm super excited about this conversation, is nobody other than Chris Jones, former research engineer at the University of Iowa and author of the newly published Swine Republic, which came out this month from Ice Cube Press, a regional press in the Iowa area. This book is making some big waves, and as you hear this conversation, you will understand why. Chris is a researcher of water quality, and boy, did he manage to get under the skin of the agricultural lords in his home state of Iowa. So, Chris, first give us a little thumbnail of your history as a water quality researcher, because you've been in that game for a long time in various different iterations.
Sure. Thanks, Katie. So I worked many years in Minnesota at a contract testing laboratory, and then I did consulting work up there for about 5 years for water and wastewater utilities. Then I accepted a job in 2003 with the Des Moines Water Works, which is a municipal drinking water utility for the Des Moines area. I went from there and worked at the Iowa Soybean Association, which is a checkoff ag organization that promotes the use of soybeans, and they did some environmental work with farmers. And so I worked there for 4 years. And then the last 8 years I've spent at the University of Iowa here as a research engineer, managing the university's network of water quality sensors, and then doing a research of my own on contaminant hydrology in agricultural landscapes.
Now, didn't you actually set up that whole sensor program, which expanded enormously under your 8-year tenure, right?
Well, the sensors have been around for about 20 years now. And when I worked at the waterworks, Hawk Company came, their sales representative came to me and suggested we try out these devices in the treatment plant, which we did. And they worked so well that I thought, geez, there might be an application in rivers for these things. And so with some other folks, we got one of these deployed in the Raccoon River near the small town of Van Meter, Iowa. And I think that was in 2006. To my knowledge, that was the first deployment of that sensor in a stream measuring water quality continuously. After that time, some people from the University of Iowa came over and talked to me at the waterworks, and they were interested in this, having known that we had done this successfully. And so the sensor network had its roots here before I came over here, but it was already established at a sort of a small scale. And since I had been here at the beginning of these sensors in rivers, I was a candidate to come over here and help manage this, which I did.
And so you started writing a blog about what you found as a water quality researcher. And why did you feel like you needed to start that blog?
When I came over here, they encouraged all the research staff to set up web pages, which I did. And I had done a fair amount of writing in my previous jobs, and I felt like I was an adequate writer. And so I thought this might be an outlet for that. And so early on, I posted essays targeting general audiences about the data. And the first couple years, really not many people read the pieces. And then I wrote one that was called This Is What Happened, which was a history of Iowa agriculture and how it was manifested in our water quality.
Uh-huh.
That one was read pretty widely. And after that, I thought, well, there was maybe a space here for people, for someone like me to write about this topic towards general audiences. And so that I did. And from my perspective, you know, to write about this in a real sort of genuine way, you know, you have to write with just sort of some naked honesty, I would guess. And I think that's what drew people to the blog, because I think so much of what we hear about agriculture and the environment is getting filtered through the ag media and then the agencies, which also are sort of reluctant to upset or get under the skin, as you would put it, of the ag titans here. And mm-hmm. so I think that was sort of the history of the blog, I guess.
And then how long did it take for you to get in trouble? Because we should explain to people that you actually had to resign your position. Tell us, take us through what just happened to you, because this is a crucial part of this story. Just as a matter of course, aside from the success of your book. So,
well, I want to say throughout the entirety of me writing the blog until recently, the university had been supportive of it. And I was never told to write, to not write something. I never had anything I wrote edited or censored in any way. Mm-hmm. And I did not submit pieces for review prior to posting, except on a very few occasions where I thought the piece was, you know, perhaps overly provocative. And no one above me censored it. No one said anything. And then at the end, there was a couple guys in the legislature that came to the university of lobbyists and said, look, you know, you guys are over here asking for funding for various programs. We really don't feel good about that. As long as you're letting this guy continue to write these pieces in his blog. And mm-hmm. so the two guys in the legislature both happened to be farmers also. Mm-hmm. And so my boss came to me and said, look, you know, this has gotten to be a problem. And so I knew this day could come eventually, right? And so it wasn't a shock. We agreed that I would write one more piece that would be published on the university domain, and then that I would consider taking the blog to an off-campus domain.
Right.
I wrote the last piece, and I very gently implied in the last piece that these two legislators had pressured the university to take this step, and I think I said in there that I knew the whole time I was writing these essays, I was like a dog chasing cars. And even a three-legged dog like me can get too close to the rear wheels once in a while. And I said that happened. Mm. And they wanted that taken out of there. And I was told that I could not say or imply that this was happening under pressure from the legislature. And
right.
to me, that was just too much. And I said that, you know, this was not really a free speech issue. This was an ethics issue, in that I was being told that I could not mention or imply something that objectively happened. And at this point, I started thinking, you know, really seriously about whether I wanted to continue working.
Mm.
And so I waited about a week and decided to retire. And so that's the story of the end. I really wasn't forced to resign. You might characterize it as I resigned under protest, perhaps. But I think, you know, the letting people in the legislature dictate what researchers can say or not say is a pretty dangerous place for an institution of higher learning to go.
I could not agree with you more. I mean, I think it's absolutely appalling. And yet it is absolutely not uncommon. And I remember years ago when I was doing book publicity for a living myself, I'd worked on a book called University Inc. By a young woman named Jennifer Washburn. And it outlined the kinds of deals that are struck very often preclude unfavorable research from being published in the service of donations from XYZ company or corporation. In other words, all kinds of research gets suppressed or pushed to the side when it doesn't meet the donor's expectations. So while it is shocking, it is not unusual in any sense. And that book, by the way, came out probably 20 years ago. So I'm sure it's gotten worse. So when you decided to put the blog together into the Swine Republic, long before this all came down for you.
Yeah. And in fact, someone from the University of Iowa Press, and so this is a big writing school, and we have the Writer's Workshop here.
Yeah, of course. Very famous.
Very, very famous. And so the University of Iowa Press, one of their editors came to me a few years ago, it was before COVID, and said, well, would you like to do a book? And I had not had, you know, that objective. It was not a career objective for me, although it certainly is for many faculty people. And I said, well, sure, why not? And so she had me put together a proposal, and I spent, you know, a fair amount of time editing the blog posts to get them in book form. And then I never heard anything for a long time. And finally, I was forwarded an email saying the director of the University of Iowa Press hated it. and he really denigrated it from almost every angle. The content, the writing style, everything. And
what a pretentious jerk.
That's what I thought. And so I
shame on him.
I sort of dropped the idea, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And then
that
the
would
same
have discouraged
editor,
anyone.
Yeah. And so then the same editor person came to me maybe a year or two later and said, well, why don't you try this Steve Semkin at Ice Cube Press? And he wanted it. And so I guess the rest is history.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, even here at the University of Iowa Press, you know, where we have this world-renowned writing school and this publishing house, there's some recalcitrance to say anything bad about agriculture.
Well, let's talk about why that is. I mean, your book relates the true story of water quality in the state of Iowa, not just in, like, a lot of my listeners who've been with me a long time know that I covered the Des Moines Water Works lawsuit quite extensively. I had Bill Stowe on probably 3-4 times. I've had Art Cullen on a bunch of times from Storm Lake Times to talk about water quality and the siting of CAFOs and everything. Talk about what did you find and why should people like have their hair on fire about this? Because I, personally speaking, I would. I already do, and I don't live in Iowa.
So, you know, I think we should have our hair on fire in regards to the water, simply because the industry treats us as not deserving of clean water. And so this is something I reject. And we hear all the time that, okay, we're a farming state and we have to be ready to tolerate some degraded condition of our water and our other natural resources. And I just reject that. And I think we've sort of abdicated our role as citizens by just letting the industry run roughshod over the natural resources that belong to all of us. And, you know, that's my main issue here. Now, sure, the water, there are health concerns. There's concerns from, you know, an aquatic life perspective and habitat and all these other things.
Sure.
That should make people angry, without a doubt. But I think the idea that we're just supposed to accept this is something as citizens that I thought we should reject.
Right. But the other thing to point out here, Chris, is that like so many other polluting industries, you know, they're not being forced to pay for the true cost of their external. So what's happening is taxpayers are ending up, you read a lot about a money loop between taxpayers and farming, which we'll talk about in a second. But the taxpayers are on the hook for paying higher water rates because they have to ever improve the water filtration systems in their municipalities. Isn't that true? So you're not only participating in the other money loop, but you're also participating in having to pay to clean up your own water by an entity that is blithely polluting it from upriver counties, such as the suit that was brought in the Des Moines Water Works.
So that's right. There's all sorts of externalities with the industry that we don't hold them accountable to.
Right, right.
At the same time, then we have to pay to clean up our water and to mitigate the pollution. And what gets me is that as taxpayers, then we're also asked to subsidize the production system and to indemnify it with publicly supported crop insurance and other subsidy programs. Taxation, for example, very favorable taxation policy for farmers, all sorts of things, driving heavy equipment on roads.
Sure.
You know, there's just a big laundry list of things, the way the public subsidizes this operation. Then we're asked to pay to mitigate the pollution. And I think this policy is perverse.
Right. And then there's also the fact that that it's voluntary conservation, that there's no regulations that have been written into the law that force these guys to say not plant crops right up to the very edge of a river, for example. I mean, you went on, there was one or two essays about that, about like, you know, why are we not creating bigger buffer zones? Well, because they might lose 0.1% of their, you know, crop yield because they haven't planted right to the edge of the riverbank.
I agree with that, you know, there should be some rules. And since we subsidize the system, since we pay farmers and the industry to do what they do in terms of government programs, then we ought to have a say in how the system is operated.
Mm-hmm.
And we being the public. And if that means having our streams buffered from crop production, or, you know, banning certain practices that we know to be environmentally degraded, you know, I think that's reasonable, completely reasonable.
I think it's completely reasonable. I know that a lot of farmers probably have their voodoo dolls out and are sticking pins in it furiously because you had the nerve to suggest that, you know, they should be paying for this remediation rather than the taxpayer through, as what you described earlier, all the crops insurances and you know, the money that you get for putting your land in conservation and all the rest of it. I don't want to spend too much more time on that, but there is a real, you wrote about the big ag and the cropaganda, which I loved. The cropaganda that allows this stuff to happen. In other words, what I'm trying to get at here is that the sort of your elected officials right down to your judiciary seem to have been bought and paid for by the industry, you know, concerns that operate blithely in your state. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about, you know, what that really is all about, like the, you know, your elected officials, your judiciary. Be specific on how that has had an impact on sort of the lack of any kind of real regulation to mitigate some of this stuff.
So I will say I'm not accusing any individual of being bought and paid for, but to pretend that agriculture doesn't have an outsized influence on our political process here, you know, is crazy. It most certainly does. And so I think, you know, farming is part of our culture here. And so almost everyone knows somebody that farms, or they grew up on a farm, or, you know, a relative farmed. You know, it's very, very common, especially people of my generation. Mm-hmm. It's becoming less so. But nonetheless, the culture of agriculture is really part of the fabric here. And so that extends especially into our political processes. And so when we look at our legislature, about 25 to 30% of our legislature is made up of farmers, but only less than 2% of our population is a full-time farmer.
Right.
So 2% are farmers, and, you know, 30% of our legislature is farmers. And so that is an example. And so our political process is very much controlled by the farmers themselves and then agribusiness. Mm-hmm. And so as the population of farmers has declined over the last 75 years, well, a lot of that, a lot of those people have been absorbed into agribusiness. And so agribusiness is huge now.
Sure. I mean, you have Smithfield, you have the big JBS plant. I mean, I'm on the meat side of things. That's what I know about. But you are the biggest swine producing state in the United States. I mean, talk for a second about what that means in terms of the manure, because this is why I really want people to understand what you're dealing with here. You know, that there's like the untreated sewage of, you know, 135 million animals or so. I forget what the number is, Chris. Refresh me on that. But you had very good statistics.
At any one time, we have 25 million hogs. And so a hog reaches market weight at 6 months of age. So, you know, we bring 50 million hogs to market every year. Mm-hmm. We have 4 million beef cattle, 5 million turkeys. We're the largest egg producing state. So we have 80 million laying chickens. I think we have about 4 million broiler chickens. We have a fairly sizable dairy industry with 220,000 dairy cattle. And so, you know, all these animals, especially the hogs and the cattle, excrete a lot of waste. And so when I look at the population of all our animals and then look at the literature values for the amount of waste they're excreting, and I convert that to a human equivalent, we've got about 168 million people living here in terms of our fecal waste.
Wow.
You know, actual human beings that live here is only about 3 million.
Right.
And so this is a colossal sort of challenge for the state to try to manage this waste. And, you know, we have areas of the state, especially where with hogs, where the confinements are very concentrated. And so, you know, it's much like the Chesapeake Bay, where you can't find enough land to apply the manure. Mm-hmm. There's just so many animals. As a consequence, where we see high density of livestock here in Iowa is also where we see our worst water quality. And again, there's really not much to regulate this activity. There are some rules, but they're very favorable for the farmer and were largely written by the industry. And as a consequence, you know, we have this environmental degradation from all these animals.
Right. And then you have the additional environment degradation brought along by the growing of two crops, soy and corn, which Iowa is famous for, and which feeds all of those animals, and the ethanol program, which doesn't look like it's going to go away anytime soon. We're going to take a short break for a sponsor drop. Chris, stay tuned, everybody. We'll be right back. We have a lot more to cover here. In fact, as I said to Chris, we may need another session. Stay tuned.
Forever Cheese, a leading importer of cheese and specialty food, has sourced exceptional products from Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Croatia for 25 years. Offering a wide selection of artisan cheese, charcuterie, nuts, crackers, preserves, and more, their products are sold in stores nationwide. Forever Cheese seeks out the best of the Mediterranean and focuses on sharing stories from their family of producers. Each product has a unique story, and their goal is to celebrate each one. From drunken goat to genuine Fulvi Pecorino Romano, Mostarda to Mitica Marcona almonds, and Duya to Jamón Ibérico, Forever Cheese is proud to offer products they love from people they believe in. Their passion, quality, and range are unmatched. Learn more at forevercheese.com and look for their products in a grocery store, restaurant, or specialty food shop near you.
Okay, so we were talking about how much manure there is that is unprocessed, like, in a municipal situation that would go through a wastewater treatment process, right? And all of the solids would be cleaned, blah, blah, blah. This doesn't happen on all of these CAFOs and farms. And so this is untreated waste, which is sprayed on fields at particular times of the year with very little oversight, correct? And there's something called a manure management plan that has to be filed by anyone who has a lot of livestock. I think it's over 1,000 head of any particular thing. But it's one thing that I wanted to ask you about, because we are going to run out of time because it's just like so much fun to talk about this. What have you seen? No, wait. First, I want to talk a little bit about the myth of the farmer in Iowa, because, you know, Americans have bought into the myth of the cowboy, lock, stock, and barrel. Mm-hmm. And that's why we love our guns, among other reasons. But the myth of the farmer is, I think, just as powerful and even growing in power. Maybe not quite so much on the East Coast, but still I'm a member of a conservation district here in Southern Rhode Island, and we are positively reverential about our farmers. But of course, mm-hmm. they're not producing 50 million hogs a year, right? If they were, I don't think we'd feel that way. But in Iowa, and in a lot of the Midwestern states, there is a real kind of reverence toward this idea that we're feeding the world, which is also propaganda that is set out by the meat industry, to excuse all of their excesses. Mm-hmm. Can you describe that, how that myth sort of came into being in Iowa and how it really does control sort of the trajectory of the state?
So, yes, we like to think of the farmer as this sort of rugged agrarian, right, that's scratching out a living against all odds with weather, of course, being a big factor, and having little control over the overall economy and the demand for the products that are produced on the farm. And, we really don't have that anymore. And so we're down to about 80,000 farmers here in Iowa. About half of them are full time. And what we do here is we grow corn for ethanol, and then we produce meat protein for the world's wealthy people. And so the idea that we're feeding the world here is just a myth. And, the truth is, a lot of these farmers, not all of them, but a lot of them are pretty wealthy people. And so when we look at the average income of an Iowa farmer, it's about $134,000 a year.
Right.
Well, the average income of an Iowan is about $47,000 a year.
Wow.
And so when we look at their wealth, of course, farmers, oftentimes have a lot of accumulated wealth too, in terms of their land especially, but other capital assets as well. And so the idea that the Iowa farmer is this rugged agrarian that's just squeaking by is just not accurate.
Right. And
the other thing too, in a corn soybean system, the dirty little secret here, and farmers joke about this amongst themselves, it's really not that hard just to grow corn and soybeans if you don't have livestock. And you hear farmers say, well, my rotation is corn, beans, in Miami.
And that's pretty funny, Chris.
it's true. And so, corn and soybeans, it's 2 weeks planting, 2 weeks spraying, 2 weeks harvesting, and then go to Florida or to Scottsdale. And which is fine. I mean,
sure.
if all of us, if many of us were presented with the same situation, we would do the same thing. And, but I don't see where the public should subsidize this activity, nor should we have to pay to mitigate the pollution. And You know, I say all the time, I do a lot of presentations. I say all the time, the problem isn't that farmers are evil. The problem is that they're human beings and they're making the same decisions that many of us would make under similar circumstances. And that's why we need policy. We need more effective policy to get the environmental outcomes that we want.
Well, you have five proposals for improving water quality, and I want you to run through what those are.
So I do have my five, and I say all the time.
I like your five.
I just say we need laws, right?
Right.
People say, well, what can we be done? And I say, well, the first thing we need is laws. And so there's common sense things we could do now that would produce better water quality now. Would they completely solve the problem? No, I don't assert that. But I think, you know, if we're going to pay money to farmers to try to get better environmental outcomes, then we ought to expect some common sense rules too. And so my first one is fall tillage. And so we only have about 20% of our land here in Iowa is no-till. And so most of the farmers are conducting tillage of some sort. And when they till in the fall, that leaves that soil very vulnerable to erosion, you know, until the next year when the corn has formed a canopy, which is, you know, June. And so we have wind erosion here in Iowa. This past winter was the worst wind erosion I'd ever seen.
No kidding.
Why do we allow this to happen? The ag universities have been putting out guidance on fall tillage since the 80s. They all say one thing, that is, don't do it. And so why do we allow this? We need to ban manure on snow and frozen ground. And so when we know when the snow melts, you know, that manure gone, right, to the stream network.
Right, goes right down to the stream, right?
We do have some rules, but they're, you know, riddled with loopholes. And when this is worse, is in the month of March. And so after February 28th, they can apply manure to snow and frozen ground. Well, I mean, that's when it's most likely to run off into the streams. And so why do we allow that?
Right.
We have over 400,000 acres in the two-year floodplain here in Iowa that are cropped to corn and soybean. And so every other year, on average, all the inputs to that land gone to the Gulf of Mexico because it's flooded every other year. And so why do we allow this? You know, and along those lines, we don't require stream buffers. And so farmers farm right up to the stream edge, to the brink of the stream.
Right.
You know, if we cannot protect our riparian corridors, there truly is no hope. This is just conservation 101.
Yeah.
Is to protect the riparian corridor.
Absolutely.
The fourth one is Iowa State University. Has their what they call their end rate calculator. This is a recommended amount of nitrogen applied to corn here. Nitrogen pollution in our streams is our worst problem. We know that statewide farmers are probably 30 to 40 pounds above that recommended amount per acre. You know, let's make farmers adhere to these ISU recommendations. We should be able to do that. Then my last point is we need to redo the master matrix livestock siting law here in Iowa.
Right.
That's been in place for about 20 years. This is a classic race to the bottom type situation where we made our laws as lax as possible to try to attract the industry. Our counties have no authority to really to restrict the siting of these facilities.
Wow.
They're not allowed to zone in a very effective way. And as a consequence, it's very easy to get a construction permit for a new CAFO. And because of that, you know, our hog population has doubled over the last 25 years.
Oh,
we have about 8,000 CAFOs in Iowa now that required a construction permit. And so we really need, if the livestock industry is going to operate here in an environmentally responsible way, we really need to redo the master matrix laws that we have.
And do you see, like, since the Vilsack 2.0 has happened, are you seeing the Biden administration making any kind of noise about getting involved in any of these issues?
Not at all. And so Michael Regan, the EPA head, actually came here to Iowa a couple years ago and said publicly, you know, we're not going to regulate agriculture. We're not going to do that. And Tom Vilsack, who you probably know, was governor of Iowa, turned governor of Iowa, Democrat, now the Secretary of Agriculture for the second time.
Right.
He has mocked, openly mocked the farm to fork program they have in the EU to address climate change, greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture. He said, you know, no, we're not going to do that here. We're not doing that in the U.S. We're not going to regulate agriculture. And so I see Vilsack as very much just establishment agriculture and not really, I don't see that Vilsack has prioritized environmental outcomes from agriculture. That's my take.
Right, right. And we could talk about the carbon capture pipeline that he's ramming down throats of Iowans, but I'm not sure we have time for that. There are a couple other things I want to talk about before we end this, and then maybe you'll come back another time to sort of speak more globally. But I wanted to ask you, like, you know, you worked in Minnesota for a while. You live in the Midwest. Like, how are other big agricultural states like Minnesota, Illinois, Kentucky, Indiana, like, how are they managing their agricultural, for lack of a better word, inputs, you know, in the form of nitrates, phosphorus, and animal waste? Like, do they have stricter rules than Iowa, or is it everybody doing the same thing?
So we should say there are problems in other states, and we see that elsewhere. Especially Western Lake Erie Basin, we hear about a lot. As far as the Corn Belt states, Minnesota has attempted more of a regulatory approach, especially when it comes to nitrate and groundwater. Mm-hmm. And so there are rules in Minnesota for farmers that have to, the rules restrict nitrogen application rates. It requires farmers to undergo various training in terms of nitrogen application if the groundwater in their area is contaminated. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, Minnesota has a 50-foot buffer. All their perennial streams, it's required that they be buffered 50 feet on each side, so no crops can be grown there. So it's common sense things, for sure. Mm-hmm. But the thing we see in other states around us that's sort of different is that so much or such a high percentage of our land is farmed. And so, you know, that's what really separates Iowa, is that we really have none of the natural environment left here. I mean, if it can be farmed, it is farmed. And so when you have some natural areas, when you retain some natural areas, that tends to buffer the effects of farming. And we just don't have that in Iowa.
Right. Good point.
And so, you know, in terms of the regulation, you know, the more intense your production system is, the more you need regulation. And so I always make this sort of analogy. If you live in a tiny town of 100 people, well, how many rules and regulations do you need to make it work? Not many. But if you live in Chicago, you know, you need a lot of rules and regulations to keep things running smoothly. And so, you know, if one person doesn't get their car off the street after a snowstorm, you know, it's a disaster, right?
Sure, right.
And so the same holds true with agriculture. Do we really need to regulate a 10-acre cornfield in Western Kentucky? Well, probably not. But in terms of Iowa, where we have virtually everything farmed, if we're going to get the environmental outcomes that we want, we need some rules.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to have to wrap it up in a couple of minutes, but I would be unfair to you and to the Swine Republic
if I did not point out to people that this book is studded with witty sayings. It wasn't until I sort of got to the end of the book that I thought, Jesus, I really want to tell people about some of these things. I mean, the Cropaganda, for example, was a great, I mean, like that was a new one for me. And you described it as the Joseph Goebbels School of Journalism. Yeah. I mean, I'm telling you, people, I was like, our politicians swoon like teenage girls when those barnyard beetles take the stage. This is referring, of course, to like the farmers who are, you know, acting like they have, you know, mud caked on their boots when actually they're wearing their, you know, Loro Piano suits to their board meetings. But, you know, whatever. There was another, soil health consulting firms, so many of which seem to be sprouting like pigweed in a soybean field with a Roundup hangover. I mean, Chris, this is gold. Yeah. I mean, honestly, nobody could resist witticisms of this type. I mean, even the staunchest ally of Monsanto, John Deere, and Smithfield would be hard pressed not to crack a smile at some of the witticisms that you came up with in this book. I want you to give you a moment to promote the book. Do you have events coming up? Is there a website that people can learn more? I know on your University of Iowa webpage, which has not yet been removed, people can still tune into your podcasts, one of which is with my best buddy there, Tom Philpott. I absolutely adore Tom Philpott. We were yodeling your praises 2 weeks ago because he was on the show.
Well, he wrote the foreword for my book, and yeah, it is beautifully written.
He's a good writer.
I want to say that. Yeah. Very beautifully written.
Yep.
So the book, I do have an event in Des Moines this Saturday. It's at Ray Gun. I don't know if your listeners have heard of Ray Gun, but they make t-shirts and they're very famous in Iowa.
Uh-huh.
For great. Sort of putting witty sayings on t-shirts. And so I'm having an event at their store on Saturday. I'm having an event tonight in Cedar Rapids.
Cool.
And so, the book, look, I wanted the haters to read it. I wanted the haters to read the essays. And as you say, my hope was that, some humor sprinkled here and there would entice them to read the essays and maybe think there was some merit to the composition, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they hated the content. And
they'll hate the content. Oh, my God. Yeah. Like I said, if they're not sticking pins in their voodoo doll of Chris Jones, baby, your head is probably shrinking without you even knowing it as they mumble their incantatory curses.
Well, I wonder if they're the ones making my belly get larger than they stick.
That's all the nitrates you're eating in that water maybe, you're drinking. Maybe. Anyway, thank you so much, Chris. The book, again, for people is The Swine Republic, Ice Cube Press. The author, Chris Jones, has an incredible presence in this book. And I hope that people can access, your podcasts and that you'll be continuing to do this really important work. I mean, we didn't get to why the Iowans are so complacent, but that'll be for the next show.
Okay. Very good. Yeah, I'm going to write another book. So
good. That's great. Yeah. I look forward to it. And I'll be keeping up with what you're doing. And maybe you'll come back in a few weeks and we'll talk some more about some of the bigger issues that this represents just in terms of how we pursue food production in this country. Because what we're doing now, it's not going to work for us for the long term, people. Right. Anyway, thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you,
I really
Katie.
Appreciate your time. Thanks, as always, to my sponsors. And we'll see you next week, folks. Appreciate you tuning in today. Bye-bye for now. What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts, Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.